Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Today I talk to homelessness advocate Paul Tavares. Tavares is in the middle of a campaign called 90 Days and Nights in the Cold, wherein he's trying to raise money and awareness about the issues around homelessness and the people that suffer from it. His mission is timely in the Guelph context, as Mayor Kim Guthrie recently completed his task force on homelessness and is trying to rally funding for the recommendations that came out of it. So awareness has never been higher, but might society be in a position to actually do something about it this time? That's a good question that someone like Tavares is uniquely qualified to answer. Being out in the cold is the topic of this edition of the Guelph Politicast. If you Google Paul Tavares' name, you will learn that sleeping outside is not a new thing for him. Yes, he has raised awareness before on homelessness issues. In 2016, he also spent 90 days in the cold and raised nearly $14,000 in the process, but Tavares also has the experience of living on the street in a not-so-voluntary way. When he camped out in Cambridge's Dixon Park to raise awareness, it was a homecoming source because Tavares would occasionally sleep there the two times he found himself homeless. The 2019 version of 90 Days and Nights in the Cold is even more ambitious. He's planned a tour of the province that's been taking him to one city per week for the 13 weeks he's decided to sleep outdoors. And if you've paid attention to the weather these days, they have not been pleasant weeks to sleep outdoors. He's been to Kitchener, Hamilton, and his home city in Cambridge, and he plans to pass through Sault Ste. Marie, Sudbury, North Bay, Thunder Bay, Ottawa, Cornwall, Kingston, Peterborough, and Toronto. Interestingly, Tavares tried three times to set up in Guelph, and in fact, it was the original plan for this podcast that I would go mobile and meet Tavares at his campsite, but he had to pack it in after one night. Why? Tavares didn't want to get into it, but it remains a dangling thread of curiosity that in a city trying hard to address the issue of homelessness, that it would be so hard for Tavares to find somewhere to set up his camp in Guelph for a week to raise awareness about it. So safely warm indoors on this week's Guelph Politicast, I talked to Tavares about his mission to raise awareness about homelessness and about whether the media is doing a good enough job for its part in trying to raise awareness too. We also discuss how Tavares' lived experience with homelessness drives him and what it's taught him about the best way to deal with the issue, and we talk about why it might be more beneficial to spurn private groups and individuals to act instead of putting pressure on government and aid agencies. And we also talk about why addressing homelessness is a community effort that should be shared by everyone. So I caught up with Paul Tavares last week in studio. So Paul Tavares, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
You're doing this tour, 90 days in the cold, days and nights in the cold. And you've been trying to bring it to Guelph for the last couple of weeks, and it seemed like you had finally managed to find somewhere to land and set up down on Clare Fields. But I want to talk first about the difficulty it has been for you to try and find some place to bring the tour here in Guelph. What has been the root of this difficulty?
I'd rather not focus on the difficulty of me coming here, just knowing that I've had some difficulties. I've had several people attempting to find a location for me here, and that's it. There's reasons why I left from Clare Fields, and that's where it is. I stayed one night. It's coming up to my second night, and a situation came to the forefront, and I decided to pack up and leave.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. That's all it is, okay? And mm-hmm. I'd rather not focus any more attention on that.
Okay, fair enough. Because it seems like this has been a fairly positive campaign. This has been, you know, I've seen a lot of good coverage of you, a lot of good press. A lot of people are saying, like, hey, here's somebody who's, you know, trying to draw attention to this, trying to make the point. We have serious homelessness issues in this in our area, not just in our area, but across Ontario, across the country. This has been a fairly positive way to raise awareness.
I think so, especially this year. The media 2 years ago was very helpful in bringing it to the forefront while I stayed in Cambridge. And knowing that I'm going province-wide this time, 13 cities, I made an effort to engage the media prior to launching the event. Back in November, on the 21st of November in Cambridge, for three consecutive days, I was on three different media outlets, TV, radio, and newspaper. So
all the bases.
Yeah, I touched all the bases in three consecutive days, and that was more of a publicity stunt of sorts. The temperature dropped to minus 25 that night, so I decided what better night than with minus 25 and snow accumulation and everything else that night. So CTV Kitchener showed up at my tent, recorded an interview, and the incoming mayor of Cambridge was there at the time, and they interviewed her as well. The following morning, I was on Kitchener radio station, Dave Rocks, 107.5. And then the following day, on Black Friday, November 23rd, they call it Black Friday because of the shopping season,
right.
I guess.
The irony is not a lot right? lost
so
on us. Yeah.
It was, it wasn't much of a Black Friday. It's interesting because it was also my brother's birthday, but I was on the front cover of the Waterloo Region Record. So those three consecutive events and other media coverage since then and some prior to that date has helped to start the momentum and make the awareness there that, hey, I'm coming, right? I've had other radio stations and media outlets approach me. I did, believe it or not, I did two live feeds simultaneously. there was a week ago Saturday, I was live on 900 CHML in Hamilton.
Yeah.
And Mix 97 in Belleville recorded a piece for the same time slot.
Oh, yeah.
So I was on two different radio stations, 1 AM, 1 FM, I believe both of them were Canada-wide, on the same time slot. So that was kind of surreal.
It strikes me as something I'm interested in terms of how we in the media cover homelessness and issues around homelessness. Because I feel like what you're doing has been able to play into something that is fairly easy for us in the media to do, which is to cover somebody doing something. But when it comes to digging down into like the roots of homelessness and the causes and trying to find solutions, I feel like that's where we kind of fall down on the job. So seeing it from your end, maybe you can offer a bit of constructive feedback to those of us in the media. What aren't we doing? I mean, we're giving you attention for your campaign, which is all about trying to get attention to the issue. But in terms of just, you know, the day-to-day, covering what we need to address homelessness in this province, what are we missing?
I'm not sure that there's much missing in relation to the media coverage. I believe the media does probably more than their share to bring the issues to the forefront. And there's lots of private individuals that design their own social media site and have a following themselves. So between social media and mainstream media, if you want to call it that, with TV, newspaper, and radio, but there are also online.
Yeah.
The face of radio is changing with the internet and everything else, and all of these social media sites that are run by cheaper equipment, smaller, less overhead, all that kind of stuff.
Yep, yep.
The quality of the output, unless it was a live broadcast, can be touched up and everything else and made to look like a professional presentation. So that gap is changing between the private sector and registered media, right? Regulated media. So their coverage, I think, is pretty good. I think city-wise and private citizen-wise, more action, less talk, right? There's so many committees and there's so many groups that just gather data and present those data to the agencies that provide the support and the government agencies that provide the funding and everything else. And there seems to be so much of that.
Right.
Right? Where people are talking about it.
Yeah. Right?
Or, like I said, creating a social media site and having concerns voiced on social media. In Hamilton, mm-hmm. so far, I've noticed an overabundance of groups out there on the street actually doing stuff.
Mm.
Okay? And yeah, they may have sat down together and thought out the processes involved. And the one group that I was with that gives out soup 4 days a week in Hamilton, one individual, don't have his name off the top of my head, but Men's Street Ministry, MSM, goes out with a truck and a trailer with soup and sandwiches and clothing 4 days a week, on a schedule 4 days a week. And quite often they do 5 and sometimes even 6 days a week, depending on the weather and their abundance of supplies and everything else. That's action. That's right. People out there actually helping directly to the people on the streets, directly to the people in need and the most vulnerable in our society. So to me, less talk, more action.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and talk about those people that are out there and what they're doing and maybe analyze it and maybe help them refine their methods and reduce overlap. Quite often I find people have a lot of clothes, right? Mm. So I've been collecting stuff. The funeral home in Hamilton was collecting stuff, and it seems there are certain items that they have an overabundance of.
Okay.
Socks would be one of those where I tried to give a few bags of socks to that one group, and they said, no, we got thousands of pairs of socks, right? So it's maybe a bit of communication where maybe within the groups, they can share. There can be like a pooling of resources of the clothing and the food that they pass out on a daily and weekly basis, some of them monthly, depending on their schedules, right?
So, I've heard that before, like right? food banks here, some food banks have too much of one item and not enough of the right. other, and it can be yeah. the opposite problem at right. another food bank.
Yeah. So shelters and food banks and these private interest groups, you want to call them, that go out on a daily or a weekly basis, maybe they can have some kind of hub where they can go online and say, check the inventory, check the stock of one group and say, okay, we got 1,000 pairs of socks and you guys got 500 blankets. Mm. Well, we could use some blankets. We'll give you some socks in exchange for some blankets. Something like that. Like
horse trading.
Like a trading, a co-op of private member service groups that go out there and they're actually doing stuff, right? So if somebody's got way too much in their basement, and a lot of people work out of their basements in their garage or whatever because, well, it's all privately funded, so they don't want to waste money on storage.
Right.
Well, if someone has storage, maybe make that public access or at least form a group of, you know, form a membership group. Form some hub where everybody can get together and maybe have a board meeting together and get together on a monthly basis and talk about what you're doing, right? There's a lot of things that I've been doing, and a lot of it has been in the media forefront. Something not so well known that it was on my Facebook. I actually went out in search of a very specific homeless person in Hamilton. A woman came to us at my tent. She got some things. There was other people there dropping off some soup and, you know, doing a photo op, and they were going to a different event. But then I joined her to seek out a very specific person that she had some things for. She hadn't seen him in a few days, and she was starting to get concerned. So we went to the usual spots that she normally found him, and he wasn't there. So she directed me to set of train tracks with a trail alongside in a wooded area, tent city kind of a place.
Sure.
And I, with my complete lack of fear and better judgment, just trudged on down the trail and found him and brought him back so that he can meet with her and get the things that she had, take some of the stuff that I had and go on his way. And some people are out there trying to do that without, say, any prior knowledge of what it's like to be on the street or any prior experience themselves being on the street. And there's some, even though they're willing to help, they're doing it blindly.
Mm-hmm.
It's like walking into here, into the University of Guelph and saying, well, I'd like to take a course.
Right.
With no idea or no plan, right? It's good to have a plan when you're going out there on the street. And most of those groups that I've been involved with and had experiences with, during my week in Hamilton was they're coordinated. The one guy said they do 15 hours of planning and preparation for every hour on the street.
Wow.
So that the coordination of gathering the clothes and washing the clothes, sorting the clothes, cooking the soup, like buying all the supplies that they need, he does 50 gallons of soup.
Wow.
A day. So
wow.
Each day on the street that he's out there, he does 50 gallons of soup. It takes a while to cook up 50 gallons of soup.
Yeah.
And cut the food. Like, it's all, and he makes it himself. It's not canned goods just dumped in. It's chop up the potatoes, chop up all the items, and make 50 gallons of soup from scratch.
Wow.
So it's cheaper that way. And it's actually better for you that way.
Yeah.
So the effort involved in making the sandwiches, cooking the soup, and all the clothing, and gathering the different volunteers and picking them up and stopping at each of the location. He was only at the YMCA for 20 minutes. And everybody that was receiving the soup and sandwiches and clothing, they were organized too. Like, they knew where to go. They lined up. They waited. They were patient. They opened up the soup truck. The window opened, they filed on through, took their soup, they grabbed the clothing items that they needed, they talked, maybe got back in line again. 20 minutes later, pack it up, move on to the next stop. They stopped at four different places that morning.
Wow.
Right? It's not like they just go to one place and they... There's three times the amount of homeless people in Hamilton than there is in Waterloo Region.
Right.
And maybe, I don't know if Guelph is included in that figure, Waterloo-Wellington figures, but... Hamilton has probably three times as many homeless people than Waterloo Region.
Mm-hmm.
And they're about the same size total, like when you add up the amalgamation that Hamilton went through and they gobbled up a lot of...
Right.
They're there at the same approximate level as Waterloo Region. So it's good that there's this many groups involved. And maybe we need more groups like that. I know Kitchener and Cambridge tried with Hand Up for the Homeless, and a lot of the health department got involved there and shut those two groups down. Those were people that are actually trying to do something, but then logistics and specifics and rules got in the way, right? Now, either the rules need to change or the groups need to follow the rules.
Right.
One of the two, right? It's there's a fine line between... doing what's safe.
Right.
When you're not reselling food, when you're giving away the food, I don't understand the using the same guidelines that they would for a restaurant.
Right.
Okay? It's not as if I don't mind having inspections of the soup or the sandwich or whatever, because they have restrictions even at the Trinity Community Table in Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
They've been doing Monday, Wednesday, Friday, feeding 150 or more people every day, probably for 25 years. They have guidelines. They have rules regarding the sandwich that they can hand you on the way out.
Right.
It's very simple. It's either peanut butter and jam or bologna. Very simple. There's no items on there that can go bad. Like, there's no mayonnaise. There's no,
right?
Those kind of things. There's restrictions on what you can hand out as a takeaway, kind of a, here's a sandwich for later, because of health concerns. There's health concerns with the temperature of the soup, with the food preparation itself and everything else, and I understand that. However, you know what I mean? It's I could talk about that one too long, and that's the way it is, though. There's guidelines that are set in place that end up being roadblocks to people that actually want to help, because the costs involved... when it's privately run, it's all out of pocket. And if there's no government funding, even with government funding, you shouldn't just go around wasting the money just to meet restaurant guidelines.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's best before dates on food.
Yeah.
I guarantee you I've opened up many boxes and cans that are beyond the best before date, even with milk or anything else. Just because it's best before this date doesn't mean you can't drink it anymore, you can't eat it anymore, all those things. And yes, there's guidelines in restaurants that you can't do this, right? So you follow the rules.
Right.
And sometimes the rules gets in the way of charity.
But I think that's part of the logistics piece you're talking about and all that prep work that goes into it, that those hours of prep work to do the 1 hour. And part of that is learning what the rules are. And maybe before endeavoring on handing something out, you make sure what the rules are. And if the rules need changing, then that should be the first piece rather than jumping in blindly and start giving out soup. And then you sort of make people dependent on a service that maybe you can't provide for the long haul.
Right. For me, though, that's part of why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to show and possibly prove eventually that the system's broken, mm-hmm. that there's too many parts of the system mm-hmm. that are broken. There's too many factors involved and too many hoops to jump through and on about starting something that mission is to do good.
Right.
And mission could be the operative word there. We're on a mission to help. And as far as I'm concerned, it's everyone's responsibility. It's the complete society. Like, every member of the community is responsible for something within the community, right? That old adage about everyone within the community is a teacher and everyone is a student.
Right.
And each of us can learn something from the other. Well, we each can help the other too. And because we're all part of the same community, mm-hmm. right? And once certain pieces of the community start to wear down, mm-hmm. the machine itself breaks down.
Right.
So we all need to get involved somehow.
Right, because there are certain people who are active in this, or, you know, in any issue, you know, mm-hmm. who are heavily involved and burn out. And then who picks up that slack?
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm curious, I think part of the effort of sort of going province-wide and touring province-wide is sort of an investigation of where people are doing things and different practices that can be adapted elsewhere. You're talking about Hamilton and how they have a bigger homelessness problem than, say, Waterloo region. I wonder if there's a matter of the factor of experience there, that it has been something that they have been struggling with longer than perhaps an area like Waterloo region, where there is more, obviously more affluence than maybe someplace like Hamilton.
I don't think it's an affluence issue. What you find is the downtown core of Hamilton mm-hmm. is larger than the individual downtown cores of each of the cities involved in Waterloo region. So right. you have Waterloo, Kitchener, Cambridge, and mm-hmm. then Cambridge itself is three distinct communities brought together to become one city.
Yeah.
So the downtown core is smaller. Each of those downtown cores that are part of Waterloo region individually are smaller than downtown Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
There's one downtown, mm-hmm. right? Hamilton has gobbled up a lot of little communities, but there's only one downtown
mm-hmm.
in the 500,000 or so people of Hamilton. Waterloo region has Waterloo, Kitchener, Cambridge.
Right.
Right? So there's three city halls, but Cambridge itself has three downtowns. Right? So any issue in any of the smaller communities is more visible. It's easier to hide in a bigger city. It's easier to find a place to put services
right.
in a bigger city. You spread them out into the four corners and you have one in the core, done. Right?
Right.
How do you do it in a smaller city? How do you do it in Guelph where everybody's there?
Right.
Everybody's in the same place. All those numbers. In a bigger city like Hamilton or Toronto or Calgary or wherever, that's bigger but dense population, well, you spread out the services and then you're going to have that many distinct groupings of homeless people.
Right.
Right? Some of them like it in the core. Some of them like it on the fringe. Some of them like it in the industrial zone. Some of them like it closer to residential. Right? So you're going to have that mix in a larger city with a denser population.
Right.
Cambridge, where I'm from, it's the downtown Galt area has the bulk of all of the homeless. The shelters there in the downtown core. So all of the homeless get serviced downtown Galt.
Mm-hmm.
There's the shelter. There's the food bank. There's the OW office, there's the addiction services, there's lots of services in downtown Galt. It has its more than its proportionate share of all of Waterloo Region's homeless.
Right.
And even on the affordable housing list, people on waiting lists for affordable housing is over 3,000 people. Cambridge has 53% of the entire list is Cambridge residents. Yet Cambridge has less than one-third of the total population of Waterloo Region.
Right.
So they have more than their proportionate share of people waiting for affordable housing and homeless people.
Right.
Similar to Hamilton having more than their proportionate share of homeless people in general, Cambridge has a larger share of those that group of people
right.
when it comes to Waterloo Region.
And that makes it easy to, you know, you're talking about everyone should be involved. But when we see it sort of centralized like that, especially in areas like Guelph, Kitchener, Cambridge, Waterloo, where it's kind of centralized downtown, if you live in areas where you were encamped down on Clarefield, it's very easy to sort of feel divorced from the problem because homelessness tends to congregate around downtown where all the services are, where the drop-in center is, where the United Church is, where the shelters are, where the food bank is, the Chalmers Food Bank. It seems like it's on a different world depending on where you are.
Yes, absolutely. And where I was situated in Hamilton was very ideal because it was close to a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. I could walk on my own to many of the services, and when I was picked up, we went to different places, right? I went closer to the downtown for the Living Rock Youth Shelter that I spoke at, and the group Hamilton Helping Homeless, delivering the soup and whatnot. They were at James Street, so other side of downtown, but it's right downtown as well at the YMCA, and they give up their soup there. And there's three other locations that they go to. I have them written down somewhere, but you know what I mean? It's
right.
It's all the groups are overlapping across the city, helping out the same group of people, and that's great. I think it's awesome that they're doing that. And even this Saturday, they're giving away tickets to the Hamilton Bulldogs. They're giving them directly to the homeless people on the street and inviting them in. They're having a charity game at 12 p.m., and they're having a hockey game at 4 p.m. with the Hamilton Bulldogs, and they're getting free tickets to the homeless for that.
Neat. Can we talk about your lived experience being homeless? Because you're coming at this not just as someone who is compassionate and cares, but someone who's lived the life. Does that make a difference, do you think? Because one of the pieces I think about is turning compassion into action, because I think there's a lot of compassion, but people get stuck on how to turn that into actual action on the issue in terms, or just, you know, are people don't know how they can get involved. But from your point of view, how is homelessness affected now that you're someone who isn't homeless? What has that taught you?
I think for me, if you look at somebody that, like you said, they have compassion,
yeah,
right, and they have a desire and the ability to give and to help, sometimes the struggle comes from missing one of the bigger pieces of the puzzle, and that's empathy.
Right.
And it's very difficult to be empathetic towards any cause without first going through that experience yourself, first having like hands-on experience, like walk a mile in their shoes, all that kind of stuff. Don't judge someone until you live their life. I lived the life of a homeless person for 2.5 years. My first stint was very short. 1997, 6 weeks, done, in and out. And that's the way it is for the majority of people who experience homelessness. They're in and out very quickly. For those that suffer more long-term or chronic homelessness, I was getting close to that window of chronic after 2.5 years, that you experience things, you see people doing things, you go from your emotional rainbow from one day to the next to where am I going to sleep tonight, or gee, I haven't done this in a while. Where's everybody going now, right? What are the services? What do I need to do tonight so that tomorrow I can go to this appointment? Working, having a job while you're sleeping in a shelter is, if you got a day shift job, great,
mm-hmm.
right? Not so bad, right? You get up with everybody else, you have your breakfast, you go off to your job. You spend the day doing your job, you come back to the shelter for dinner, you relax for a little bit, and then you go to sleep.
Mm.
I had an afternoon shift job while I was sleeping at the Bridges shelter for a stint after, so it had been 2013, I believe. And coming back to the shelter at 1 a.m., heating up the dinner that they set aside for me from that previous night, and then going upstairs to the third floor and in and amongst 40 other men that are already sleeping and snoring and whatever else, and then trying to sleep. But everybody starts to wake up around 6 o'clock, and then
right.
then they clear out that third floor, and I, whether I've had enough sleep or not, I have to wake up.
Yeah.
So if you have a day shift job and you're living at a shelter, definitely a lot easier than living at the shelter and having a midnight or an afternoon shift job, because you might as well not be there if you're not going to be there overnight.
Right.
Yeah. If you're not going to sleep for at least 3 hours, I wouldn't even go to the shelter. And that goes into the different area of people not using the traditional shelter system
right.
and the reasons why they don't do that. And that's a completely different topic. And there are a variety of different reasons for someone not wanting to be part of the traditional shelter system.
Right. And then that's another part of this too, is that it sounds incredibly naive, but maybe it's a point that's worth reinforcing, that every homeless experience is unique. That you have people who are homeless who have work, people who are homeless who aren't necessarily living on the street or in the shelter, they're couch surfing or staying with friends. Technically, they're homeless, but mm-hmm. they don't fit the stereotypical image of what a homeless person looks like.
That's a good thing, too, because
yeah.
I'd like someone to draw me a picture of a stereotypical yeah, homeless person.
That's right.
Right? Because I put forward a lot of effort when I was homeless myself
mm-hmm.
to not appear to be the stereotypical homeless person.
Right.
Right. I went about my life mostly doing everything else I would normally do when I had a job, when I had a home. And part of that was going to the YMCA 5 days a week. My same routine that I did before, and I continued that routine. That comes from a variety of pride and yeah. shame, and call it what you want.
Yeah.
But I didn't go around with a cardboard sign advertising that I was homeless. I didn't
right.
go banging on my friends and family's doors asking for help. I didn't do some of the things I probably could have done, but I felt I needed to do it on my own.
Mm-hmm. But I take it that's probably a pervasive thing, that the pride,
yeah, that's deep-rooted family kind of a thing. Yeah.
But, you know, you certainly would not be the only person who fits into that, that there are probably a lot of people who you would pass on the street and not immediately think, this person is homeless. And that has its effects, too, because, again, people have their set images, and it's sort of hard to break people of their preconceived notions, and that's, I don't know.
An issue is this, when you reach the point where you're considered chronic,
mm-hmm.
That it's persistent and it's probably going to persist on and off or continuously for the rest of your life, whether you've decided that, you've resigned yourself to the fact that you're going to be homeless for the rest of your life, and you find a level of comfort.
Right.
Not comfort from many other people's point of view, but you're okay with it. You're into a routine, and it's become part of your everyday life, and you're there. You've mm-hmm. reached that point, and there's very little anybody can do or say aside from provide you with the things that you need. And the shelters and the soup kitchens and the places that provide free clothing. Outreach workers are out there on the street, and the outreach workers in Cambridge, there's only two of them that I'm aware of, they're out there. They know where the people frequent. They seek them out off-site, which sometimes can be a little daunting based on weather and daylight and anything else. Sometimes you could go a while and not find that one person, kind of like we did in Hamilton when we were seeking out that guy on the trail. I'm not sure what would have happened if I went through that area and didn't find him.
Right.
What would have gone through her mind knowing that she still couldn't find him, right? So sometimes it's you pass the word around through the network of people on the street, hey, have you seen so-and-so? And they're like, no, I haven't seen him in a couple of days. Right, so now they're concerned too because you've alerted them that you haven't seen them and they haven't seen them. So where is that person? And the network and people care for each other on the street. They'll start looking. The word will get around. Hey, we're looking for so and so. And that's the way it works. It's everybody works together, right?
Yeah, and we try to. I think we phrase people who are homeless as a forgotten people, but. I think everyone's remembered by someone, and that I think that's another really positive thing to keep in mind is that there is still community, even among the homeless.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. I wanted, maybe to wrap up, I wanted to ask you about the political piece of this, because this is a political podcast, but you ran for mayor of Cambridge in 2014. Spoiler alert, you didn't win. But... I here in Guelph, we had our mayor, Cam Guthrie, have a task force meeting to look at ways we can deal with homelessness and safe streets. You have been part of the political process trying to run for mayor. You have been part of the advocacy process. You have the lived experience. I'm wondering your thoughts. Are there political solutions to homelessness, or is this going to be from the grassroots up, that it has to be the people that sort of take this on, whether or not politicians take part or not?
Well, you know, that's a very prophetic question that you're asking me there, because part of what I'm doing is gathering data to find out what actual are the issues facing everyone in each specific community. Are there similarities and what are the differences and everything else. But I'd have to say, unfortunately, yes, the system itself is broken. And it started long before you were born. And when I was a child, things that I was unaware of at the time, but things were happening even 40 years ago and more, that the government started changing the system, the healthcare system, and withdrawing services more from the mental health side of the healthcare system, closing facilities, combining facilities, mainstreaming mental health patients back into society, determining which members of the mental health community could function on their own, potentially, right? So my mother was part of that system, and she was placed in a group home in Cambridge, which was staffed during the day by administrative staff, by nursing staff, by there was a cook, and they helped them with their meals and everything else. But everybody went home at night, and everybody in the group home was on their own until 9 o'clock the next morning when staff started coming back in. So... It's a lot of trust involved. It's a lot of assessments on can these people truly administer their meds on their own and function within society and shop for groceries and all those kinds of things, the basics of sustaining your own life, right? But when that system breaks down, because quite often when you have a mental health issue and you're feeling better, you decide, I don't need my meds. And that happens. That's a common occurrence, widespread amongst the different levels of mental health.
Ingrained, though, because when we're talking about physical health, you stop taking your medicine once you're well.
When the pain is gone, you don't need that Advil anymore.
Right.
When the cold is gone, you don't take Neocitrin, all those things.
Right.
And it's attempted to do that with the mental health side of the thing, and they forget that the actual pill that you're taking is the thing that's keeping you happy, right? You stop taking your happy pill, and you're no longer happy within a certain period of time, right? So over a period of time, some of those changes that started 40 years ago are impacting us today. And the costs to first responders and the healthcare system now is so much greater per person, per capita, because of that. And it will probably take a lot more than 13 weeks of my 90 days, right? It'll take more than 90 days. It might take 90 people doing 90 days before it starts to even remotely look like it's going in the proper direction. And even what's happening now is it's all Band-Aids. It's all putting out fires. It's not properly reconstructing the system. And the only way you can do that sometimes, like, say, for a building, we want to put a new building here. But the only way to do that is to tear this building down.
Right?
Because this building's obsolete. We want a new building. Do we build it somewhere else and then tear this one down, or do we tear this one down and then build the new one? Regardless of which method you use, this building will be gone.
Right?
And then something else will go in its place. I think that's what needs to happen with the system that's in place now, the social services system, all the way from the transfer payment that comes from the province, or if you want to take it one step further back, the transfer payment from the feds. It's money gets transferred from one to the other, and then it gets into the region's hands or the municipality's hands, and they administer those funds, and they use those funds and create a system to help society. Well, that system is broken. It's not designed to handle all the different myriad effects of opioid crisis and mental health and the different age groups that are being stigmatized and put all together in one shelter. You have youth, you have adults, you have seniors, you have mental health and addictions and crime elements as well, because people are being released from the prison system and they're being placed in shelters, right? So you have a lot of different elements that are being fused together in one shelter. Forget the men and women in the same shelter or children and families in the same shelter. They at least do their best to separate families from the rest of the shelter. I think some effort needs to be involved in having a woman's floor, a men's floor, like, you know what I mean? It's privacy, it's security. Right. There's so many different issues involved, and piling them all in one shelter, a one-stop shopping kind of a thing, for me, it doesn't work. From what I've experienced, especially since 2011, it just doesn't work. So,
what you're talking about, though, would take some exceptional political will. Just have someone step up and say, it's not enough to address the holes in the system. It has to be torn down. This building can't be fixed, to use your metaphor. Have you ever met a politician that could say that? Maybe present company excluded.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if my running for mayor qualifies me as a politician, but I did a lot of effort there telling everybody I'm not a politician, but I'm still running for mayor. So I'd have to say no. There might have been one person, Jack Layton, NDP leader in Canada. I think he might have been one of those people. There might be a few people out there pretending to be that person. But it's funny how once people get elected that their stripes change, right? And I'd like to meet somebody who does everything that they say in their campaign. They campaign on a platform, and then they get elected, and they actually do all those things that they campaigned about. It would be refreshing to find a politician who could do that, who could make a speech, read the speech, get elected, and follow through with everything that was in that speech. I don't know too many people that have done that. I really don't. Mm. I'm 53 this year, and I don't know. I'd have to really stretch to find someone in, let's call it, Waterloo, Wellington area that has done that, mm-hmm. or even Ontario or Canada. You'd be hard-pressed to find, say, five people that followed through on every single one of their election promises.
Mm-hmm. That's a much bigger conversation, and we've had a very big conversation here today. But Paul Tavares, I wish we could have kept you in town a bit longer, because I think you have a lot to offer on this conversation, and I thank you for coming in and offering your insights here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And once again, that was Paul Tavares. He's currently encamped in Belleville, and you can learn more about his campaign and follow along with it on Facebook at facebook.com/PG/90daysandnights. And you can also follow Tavares on Twitter at @PaulDPRTTavares. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics. It's Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to Guelph Politico on Facebook at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you would like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.